Hey, this is Melissa, creator and founder of Femtrepreneur, and you're listening to Fem Radio. Don't forget to subscribe to the Fem Radio podcast wherever podcasts are found so that you can be notified when each episode goes live. Dr. Cassandra LeClaire is an author, professor, communication consultant, and motivational speaker. Cassandra's mission is to educate individuals on how to have effective and healthy communication to enhance their relationships. She works to help others gain an understanding of their communication practices to improve their relationships with friends and family members in the workplace and beyond. Cassandra completed her PhD in communication studies at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where she focused on interpersonal and family communication with a specialization in women's and gender studies. Dr. LeClaire teaches a variety of classes at the collegiate level, where she encourages her students to explore their own patterns and improve their communication. Her teaching and research interests fuel her campus and community involvement. She is active in many local organizations that seek to empower and educate individuals on relationships and identity. I recorded this episode with Dr. LeClaire back in May, so it is being released a few months after we have recorded it. I also want to give a huge shout out to Susie Vibral of Room Redux for making the introduction. Again, I'm going to mention a little bit during our intro, but this episode is going to be a little bit of a trigger if you have suffered from crisis or stress or trauma, some sort of PTSD from previous incidents in your early life. So we do talk a little bit about sexual abuse and sexual trauma. So please keep that in mind as you're listening. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. She offers so many good pieces of advice on how to cope and how to communicate the things that are affecting us on a day-to-day basis and how to allow ourselves the strength really to be able to communicate those things with the people that we love. So thank you, Dr. LeClaire, for coming on the show. And without further ado, here is the episode. Hey, Fem Radio, this is Melissa Goncalves, your host, and I have Cassandra LeClaire with me today. Hey, Cassandra.
Hey.
So excited to have you with us, and I do want to preface that we are going to be discussing a lot of important topics, a lot of things that can be rather triggering for some, a lot of, we're covering crisis, stress, trauma, all those very important topics. So if this is at all a sensitive topic for you, I just want to give our listeners a quick heads up. But Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us and making time in your day to speak to Fem Radio listeners.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited just to be able to speak to the community and to talk to you and to see where this goes.
So tell us about yourself. Give us a little bit of an insight into who we're going to be meeting today. What was your upbringing like? You know, all those good things.
So I grew up in South Dakota, and in a really rural area with my mom and my dad, and I have an older brother and a younger sister. And so I grew up in the middle of nowhere, but it really was out in the country and, you know, dirt roads, gravel roads leading up to it, really out in the middle of nowhere. And the towns I grew up in and went to school in were very small. And so it was a really close-knit area in many ways. But I kind of always had this, due to some things that happened to me, which I know we'll discuss, I kind of always just really wanted to get out of there. Even though it was a great place to live because of some of the things that I endured, I felt like it was somewhere I needed to escape. Mm-hmm. And so, I actually then stayed in South Dakota for both my undergrad and my master's for college. And then I got my PhD in Nebraska at UNL, University of Nebraska-Lincoln in Lincoln, Nebraska. And after I finished with that, that's what led me to Texas. I live in Texas now, but because I took a job after I finished my PhD at Texas State University. So it was kind of like a strange, you know, South Dakota, my whole life, then Nebraska, and then all of a sudden Texas.
Right.
And I've lived in Texas now since 2008.
So, wow. Quite the traveler, I see.
It was just a strange, but in terms of my upbringing, I know I kind of skirted around that question, but, you know, like I say, we're going to be talking a lot about different things. And I think for a long time, it was hard for me to even talk about where I was from because it was kind of a source of things that were painful to me. And one of the things I hope that people get through this conversation and through me talking about my journey is that, you know, sometimes the things that are painful to us are signal the things that we need to revisit and work through. And so even just being able to talk about where I'm from more freely and openly and talk about what it meant to me is a change. I didn't used to be able to do that as openly. So,
So when you went to college, what did you study again? And with that, like, what was sort of what propelled you to go in that direction?
So I was a communication studies major and a psychology major. And the big thing for me is I've always been somebody, and this is a detriment to as much as it's a blessing. I've always really been a people pleaser. I've really been somebody who I like to cheer people up. I like to feel like I'm helping people and motivating people. And so I always thought about being a motivational speaker. And I like to joke that becoming a professor, a communication studies professor, is like the safe academic way to be a motivational speaker. And so for me, it kind of started there. I was like, I knew I liked talking. I knew I liked to learn more about people. But ultimately, like, what it was for me is when I was in college, I took an interpersonal communication class. And it's actually one of the classes I teach now. And when I was in that class, and when I was in college, I had left home and I was lost and I was confused and I didn't know who I was. And I was just really in a space where I needed to kind of figure it out. And that class for me, the interpersonal communication class, my professor, Jill Tyler, she had us do some journaling. She had us do a lot of different activities where we had to look inward and figure out more about ourselves and figure out what our patterns were bringing to our communication and to our interactions. And when I was in that class, it was so transformative to me that it kind of propelled me on this journey to think that I could maybe do that for other people. And so I became a professor in the hopes that I could, and stuck with my communication studies training in the hopes that I could help other people figure out how to talk through some issues and talk through things that would better their relationships.
Wow. I love that. And I also love, you know, just to touch on a little bit, how you did have a professor that made such an impact on your journey that, you know, propelled you into, you know, following that career path. I think that's huge. A lot of people don't understand the value that they play on others. And is it safe to say that that professor did have that type of impact on you?
I can point to several across my education. I mean, starting way back, like I say, I wanted to be a motivational speaker. You know, my first speech teacher, Kim Davidson, way back in high school, and then my improv teacher, Sharon Prendergast. And I'm saying their names because I think that's really important too, to like really, you know, pay tribute to the people who have helped you. And then so those women in high school and in college, they were there to support me and they were there. They had no idea some of the stuff I was going through inside and interpersonally, but they just were there to support me and help me and to kind of nurture me and show me ways that you could be present and be strong. At least that's what I took away from those interactions. And so I really did have strong educational role models, and that I think, I mean, it's so important to have people who you can really look up to, who give you an idea of what's possible for yourself.
Through our conversations, obviously, and we spoke a few weeks ago, you know, you did mention that there was, you know, I could see a lot of that sort of interpersonal battle, right? The trauma that you were dealing with, and you faced a ton of struggles in your life. And one of those being that you were sexually abused. And I want to dig a little deeper into that. You know, where were you in your life when these things occurred, and how did you end up coping with this trauma at the time?
So, I mean, that's a great place to start because I think I've kind of weaved around that pretty good. So I was six when I started being sexually abused by a family friend. And so that was when I was in South Dakota. I actually grew up, in the country, but my parents owned a bowling alley in a small town in New Effington, South Dakota. And so the abuse occurred in the basement of the bowling alley that my family owned. And so I was a person at the time, you know, I was six, I was a little girl. And the person who abused me was somebody who was powerful in terms of, you know, our small town. It was a person who had certainly had more money than my family had, had a lot of influence. And so the thing that stuck with me that was the hardest, honestly, over all these years of trying to get over this horrific event, the things that stuck with me are his words, are the psychological manipulation and the terror I felt. And I believed everything he said, you know, in terms of he told me that nobody would love me and that I'd never be good enough and that no one would believe me and that, you know, my family would lose everything. And when you're a child and you see somebody who, you know, is an adult that other people respect and trust, it's really easy to believe those words, you know? And of course I look at it now and you're like, oh gosh, why didn't you just go tell your parents? Or, oh, why didn't you do this? But, you know, abusers are really, really good at figuring out ways to keep people silent. I mean, obviously that's why this is such a problem, right?
Right.
And so I instead internalized his words and decided that I was going to do everything I could to prove him wrong. And so I, you know, I definitely took everything he said and started to try to just become the best at everything. I wanted to make people smile and make people laugh and to show them, you know, that I was a valuable person or to get them to like me. And I mean, I've always had some sort of this spirit where I want to make people laugh and make people smile, but it's almost like it turned in me. It twisted already at that young age, right, where it was right. No longer to make them happy and make them smile, but it was also this piece, this underlying piece of like, in addition to wanting them to like me, you know? And right. So I started creating these patterns that became, you know, they were my coping mechanisms. Like something bad would happen and then I'd have to go do something good. Or he would make me feel awful, so then I would have to go prove myself another way. And so it was almost like this fierce competition with myself. And so by the time I was in like middle school, I started to have a lot of anxiety. But that was in a time that, you know, you didn't really talk about anxiety and depression right. that much. And the way I managed it was just to push harder. So there really is no way that like my teachers or my parents or anyone, you know, knowing what we know now, that's a different situation. But looking back on it then, you know, I wasn't the typical kid who you think of as being an abuse victim. I didn't do poorly in school. In fact, I did great in school. I still had friends. I was outgoing. Like, again, I took it a different way. And I think that that's important for me to say out loud and to talk about, because so often we don't realize that not everybody has the same coping mechanisms.
Right.
And my coping mechanisms, while they seem positive to the outside world, were still destructive for the ways that I was using them. You know, like, that's great that you want to do good in school, but is it great if it's because you're hiding under something, you know, hiding from something else, and that's right. the only thing you have? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so I just kept, there was no reason for me to get out of these patterns, because the patterns were then also simultaneously rewarding me, you know? So like, okay, I'm becoming, you know, really invested at school. Well, so then great, I'm winning awards, or I'm, you know, getting good grades, or I become really invested at making other people laugh and making other people happy. So then, you know, oh, look, I'm popular, you know? And so it was like this weird cycle I kept myself in. And, you know, I didn't ever really think back to why I was in that cycle. I just kept going and kept going. And then over the years, getting more and more and more anxious about being in that space.
Wow. And how long did it take you from when, you know, let's say from when the abuse first started, or, you know, when it first stopped, really, to actually being able to speak about it out loud? How long did that take?
Oh my gosh. It took, I did not talk about it out loud until I was 39.
Oh,
I mean,
goodness.
I didn't. So I went through my whole life, like I said, just trying to prove him wrong, like trying to show the world how amazing I was. And so I went to college, went and got my master's, got my PhD, was going to become this amazing professor. And in part, again, you know, you asked earlier why I chose communication and why I teach what I do is, and I think I said this when we spoke on the phone, is that I wanted to show other people how to have a voice for themselves that I never took for myself.
Wow.
I didn't use my voice, and I didn't talk about the things that were bothering me or troubling me, or, you know, or obviously the events that were occurring. But I knew how to listen to other people. You know, part of I think a trauma response sometimes is you get other people to talk about themselves so you don't have to talk about yourself. Because if I'm not talking about myself, then I'm not going to crack and tell you something that I don't want to talk about. And so I became very skilled at listening and being aware of other people's pain and other people's process and traumas and stress. And so I knew I could take that piece of me and use it in the classroom and use it in these workshops to help other people better themselves. And the reason I knew I could do that is because it's what I wanted to do for myself. It's what I knew would help me, but I was not yet willing to go inward and to deal with the abuse so that I could speak out loud about it, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, that alone, you know, that's so impactful to me that you were, you know, 39 before you were able to actually utter the words out loud. And, you know, it's just, it's very interesting to think about how, you know, over the past, you know, however many years, right, you've been helping others and speaking about their trauma and speaking about the things that they face and the anxiety and the stress, and you've been a communications professor, and but it took you so long. And I feel like that is something that I don't want to gloss over, right? That it was just, you can be impacted so strong by these negative experiences that you just internalize them so deep that it's not something that is second nature for you to talk about, right? Even to your close family and friends, it's almost something that's so, so difficult to speak of. And I wanna now switch to, because again, it's sort of in the interest of what's made you you and how, you know, you wrote a book, and we're gonna dive into that in a bit as well. But a few years ago, you and your family were driving and you were hit by a drunk driver. Can you tell us about how this affected you, and just given all of the things that you've dealt with in your life as well?
The accident or the crash, that was the catalyst for me. And so what happened was, yes, we were hit by a drunk driver, and we walked away with these minor physical injuries, but I walked away from it just completely rattled. I was just really shaken and anxious and stressed. And that was when I realized that it's one of those things where, I don't know if you've ever had that, where you know your reaction is not matching the situation. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I had a right to be upset and to be stressed, but I also knew the level of what I was feeling was just like over the top, because I mean, I was terrified, and not just about getting in a car. I was just on edge and terrified all the time. Mm-hmm. And so after that crash, basically what happened is it sent me back to this place of being afraid. And so memories from the abuse and just a lot more flashbacks and just painful things that I knew were always there, what I pushed aside, I couldn't push them aside anymore. All of a sudden, everything was a trigger for me and everything made me feel scared. And so it was at that moment where I knew I needed to go back and address the abuse. And so I went and I talked to a psychiatrist. I went to trauma therapy. I started journaling, and I really had to go back and face all of those memories and face everything that had ever happened to me so that I could move forward. And so, you know, when you asked about like when I started talking about the abuse, when I realized about all these patterns, it wasn't until after that. And honestly, wow. I think that it had to happen. I mean, I've been through so many different stressors in my life or different crises, and I wasn't waking up yet. And I like to say, I think the crash, like it had to happen for me to finally go back and deal with stuff. Wow. Because I'd had all of these things happen, and I was just, I never was going back to my root issue at all. And so it forced me to go into this deep healing period where I was finally I felt like I had healed halfway from so many things, and I finally wanted to be whole and I wanted to heal completely. And so that's how I wrote my book. And that's why my book is called Being Whole, because I wanted to feel that again, instead of feeling happiness in certain areas, or instead of like being happy. I was truly happy in so many ways, but yet there was always this like something inside of me that was just churning constantly that I thought was anxiety. So I'd medicate it or I'd push it away or I'd try to drink it away or whatever. But the reality was, is a lot of it was not anxiety. It was that fear I was just carrying around and I was letting it re-injure me in all of these other ways because I refused to deal with it.
Wow. So, and I can only imagine, right, that being a professor now, you're able to really use those life experiences now that you've been more vocal about it, right, in your studies and in your lessons. And, you know, what are some of the things that your students are getting out of your coursework, right? What are the things that you stress in your interpersonal communications courses?
I think the thing that it's changed for me, I've always been fairly open in the classroom, but now I tell them what it looks like kind of overall. So what I do in my classes is I almost run it a lot more like kind of mini workshops, or I try to, in terms of, okay, so say we're going to talk about, you know, breakups or relational escalation and de-escalation. Well, instead of just telling you the model and the theories for that, I'm going to take you through, let's walk through this relationship. I'm going to walk you through what I did and what I said and what the other person maybe said and did. And I'm going to tell you where I messed up. And I'm going to tell you which theory, you know, explains what I did. Because right. The point of that to me is that I know all of these things. I know everything I'm supposed to do and I still mess it up. And that's important for me to say, because that's the thing about teaching about relationships and communication and human connection, is we can all know what the books say. But when you're in those situations, we also know that our feelings and our emotions kind of take over. Right. So for me, it's telling my students that. So because my overall goal, especially in interpersonal, is that awareness piece. Okay, so we all are going to have trauma or crisis or stress or other things that prevent us from being our best self in our relationships. Like, it's just a fact, right? So if we're more aware and open about what our stuff is, you know, what our baggage is or what our patterns are or what have you, then we can take control of that. And we can also, you know, communicate that more clearly to our relational partners. Right. So then they know, you know, what our triggers are, what our stressors are. And so I think what going through my trauma again and kind of really writing my book is, that's exactly what I do, is I, in my book, I write about my patterns and I say, here's how, what I did. Here's how it didn't work. Here's why I'm doing this instead. And so it's really like I used my own life as a case study. And then that's right. What I teach my students to do. And I think it's more valuable to them now because it's not just theoretical. Like, I'm like, no, I actually did this, you know, like, you know, or the things I tell them. And so I think it's helped me because every semester then I'm, you know, as I'm telling them what I think they should do, or I'm working through these theories, I'm still doing it for myself too. And so I've experienced so much more growth, and I tell them about, you know, what I'm going through at any given moment. And then they share back with me. And so it's created this really cool space where now, you know, over the last couple of years in particular, I have these students who I'm seeing their openness and awareness, like, and it's going beyond just, you know, themselves and their own interpersonal communication, but it's changing the way they interact with other people. It's changing, you know, their levels of compassion and empathy. Because once you start realizing, you know, an awareness from yourself and what you're bringing to every interaction, I think you stop taking things so personally that other people are doing.
Right.
And that's huge in relationships. I mean, think about how often we take things personally, or we think somebody's mad at us, or we wonder what their tone was about, when so often it has nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. So. <That's true. laughs>
I know you mentioned it a few times, so I want to sort of discuss this now. So you wrote a book, you wrote Being Whole, Healing from Trauma and Reclaiming My Voice, and you self-published it. So, you know, we got a little bit of information on what prompted you to write that book. But I'm curious to know, you know, writing a book is not an easy feat, right? So what was the process like of, you know, I always say putting pen to paper, right? But more so probably hands to a keyboard. What was that process like for you, and what can our listeners get from reading the book?
I mean, the first thing I would want to say to anyone who's considering writing a book is I really think everybody should do it if that's a goal of yours, if that's something you're interested in. And for me, I will also say this wasn't a big plan. And so I think sometimes we think we have to have a big plan and we prevent ourselves from starting things because we don't know what the plan is. So I also want to kind of state that because I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a marketing team in place. I didn't have a launch budget. I didn't have all of the things where if you Google how to write a book, they will tell you to have. I didn't have any of that. All I had was this knowledge and this desire that I was supposed to do it. So I really just went full force and I just started writing. Some of it came because I was doing, like I say, going through my healing period, and I journaled a ton. And so I went back to my journals, and that's how I kind of noticed these patterns that became themes in the book, is that I went back to my journals and I basically, like I say, treated them like data and went and coded it like I would if I were doing a research study as a professor. I looked at all my stories that I had written. I looked at all of my journal entries, and I would start circling words or underlining words. And I was like, oh my God, this is what this is. These are patterns that I've been keeping myself in. So I kind of went about it backwards. Most people, you know, if I were going to write a book, I would say you should outline it and then you should write it and fill it in. But I didn't do that. next time I will. So after I did that, I was like, oh my God, I think I have this thing that could be a book. And then I realized I don't know how to publish a book. And so I reached out to people. I took a writing class from Becca Syme. She is a self-published author, and a friend had told me about her. And so I took a writing class, which is really more, it was very interesting. It was a writing class that talked to you more about your personality and the ways that, like, you can learn to write based on your own personality characteristics.
Interesting.
And, yeah, it was really cool. And you take personality tests, and it was very interesting for me because I didn't really know what to do after I had written. And I just wanted to hear from other people who were kind of self-publishing and writing, like what you do. And so Becca really helped me. When I finished writing, I reached out to her and I was just like, hey, remember me? I took this class from you and I wrote a book, but now I don't know what to do. And she was amazing because she did a couple coaching calls with me, and she actually, she helped me convert my file to get it ready to put up on Amazon because I didn't know how to do that. And she walked me through how to get it onto Amazon and onto, I've also put it on Draft to Digital, which is another platform that distributes it to Barnes & Noble and Kobo and Google Play. And so, yeah, I wrote this book and I had this Word document, but then I didn't know what to do. And so I reached out, and this is why I think it's so cool that you have this show, like, because the only reason I was able to do that book was because I reached out on a whim to somebody who I thought might be able to help me, and she was willing to do it. And that's how that happened, you know, it wasn't. And so that was really integral to me because I did this on a very tight budget. So that's the other thing I would say to people, if you're interested in writing a book, but you think like, oh, I don't have the money to pay a company. I didn't pay a company. I didn't have a lot of money. And so I would encourage you to not let those fears or those like stressors be the reason you don't do something, right. You know? So she helped me get it on Amazon and everything. And then, after that, it's just been me sharing it on social media, me telling all of my friends about it, me telling all of my students about it. And I'm just only now, that was in December that the book came out, and I'm only just now trying to figure out how to do a marketing plan and all of that other stuff. Because again, for me, this is all self-funded. And so I'm also trying to be, to figure out ways and steps I can take so I'm not blowing my entire salary to publish this book either.
right. I mean, it's so great to know, though, that it is an option, right? That on a limited budget, you can still write a book and you can still publish it. You can put it on Amazon, right? And just out of curiosity, your book is digital right now, obviously on Amazon and whatnot. But as far as like a hardcover goes or like a print version, is that an option? And did you have to go through like a specific printer for things like that?
So what I did for that, and again, I really credit Becca with helping me through so much of these questions, because I read a ton. I've read several books. I went on the internet and read everything, but there's so much information out there on how to do it. I was getting very overwhelmed and very confused.
Right.
And so actually, so what I did, and again, there are millions of ways you can do this, but what I did right now is when I uploaded it to Amazon, you can also have an option for them to print. So if somebody goes to Amazon, they can order a paperback or an e-copy. So that's the only place you can get a paperback. You can get the ebook on a lot of other platforms, but the paperback is just print to order through Amazon. So then as an author, what I can do is I can go on to the platform on Amazon and order author copies. So I can buy my, you know, so I do have like a box of books at my house that I can then take to signings or to other events and sell them that way as well. For me, because I was not ordering a huge volume, you know, I wasn't ordering thousands of books because number one, I didn't have anywhere to sell them. And number two, I didn't have the finances to do that. So for me, the print from Amazon worked out really great because I can order, you know, you can order up to 999 at a time, or you could order one at a time if you wanted to. And so, and you pay a different price when you're ordering the author copies than what, you know, somebody would pay if they ordered it off of Amazon. And so the whole investment for me, I mean, people could even do it more cheaply than what I did, honestly, because I did hire a cover designer, and I'm in love with my cover and I would do it all over again in a heartbeat. So I did hire a cover designer just because I didn't have the skill set. I didn't think, nor did I feel like I had the time and energy to try to learn to do that. And then I hired an editor. So those are the two big expenses that I had in terms of the self-publishing.
Wow. Okay. Thank you so much for that information. I know it's going to be very valuable to a lot of our listeners. So yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Well, and I think too, I really encourage people to try because there's no rules for how long your book has to be either. You know, you can, if you start looking on Amazon, there are many, and not trying to give all the credit to Amazon, that just happens to be the largest platform right now where people are putting their work. But if you start to look, self-publishing used to get a really bad rap, but now a lot of people are turning to it for a variety of reasons. And for me, the biggest reason that I went that route is because of the timeline. I really felt a sense of urgency to get my book out and to just get it in the, you know, just part of it, I think I needed to get rid of it out of my own internal mind, and I needed to get it published so I could not think about it anymore. But I think sometimes like people get really hung up on wanting a publisher or wanting an agent. But I guess for me personally, I'm really glad I went this route, and I'd encourage anybody to look into it, and I'd be happy to talk to people about it as well to share my experiences.
Wow. I love that. Thank you. I know we spoke about this when we had our initial conversation, but there's a big quote from the book. You know, you mentioned, I sought external validation because I had no internal self-worth. And I don't want to sort of sleep on this quote, right? Once you were able to understand that this is something you were doing, what changes did you ultimately make in your life that improved it and changes for the better?
Oh, that one was huge for me when I realized that. I think it made me, it's interesting, when I decided to stop kind of chasing that external validation and I just started turning inward more and asking myself like, okay, why do you want this? So like, for example, if an opportunity would come up or I'd, you know, think, oh, I have to say yes to something, I kind of have to stop myself and say, okay, well, why do you want this? And I have to really make sure it's something I want because it's something I truly, you know, want to do authentically or that inspires me or that interests me, as opposed to just jumping to say yes because it will make somebody else happy. And so some of my external validation is tied in with the whole people pleasing thing. Right. And so I'm not sure if people always realize that those two can go hand in hand a lot. But because if I'm helping you, that feels good, right? So that's validating me. But then also that in the people pleasing and making you feel good, then you're more likely to probably praise me, which also feels good, which is essentially the external validation, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. That's how it looked in the relational aspect. So what would happen for me is then, so say I say yes to going out with you, but I don't really want to, but I'm trying to make you happy, right? And trying to give you to, you know, give you to get you to tell me how awesome I am, or that I'm a great friend, right, or right. whatever. So then I go out with you, but I really don't want to be there, or I'm frustrated, or I wish I wouldn't have, or I'm anxious because I didn't just tell you I didn't want to go. So I would spend all of that mental energy and just basically make myself frantic internally while trying externally to please everybody else, you know, but because I didn't value my own self and my own opinion and my own needs enough to say, hey, Melissa, you know what? Actually, I don't feel like going, or I'm tired today, or whatever. I would never do that. I would not even save space for myself because I did not even feel worthy of having needs. And so once I realized that I was like attaching like my self-esteem and my happiness to other people liking me, I kind of was like, oh yeah, that's a problem. And so I had to stop relationally in that sense. But then it's other things too, you know, like think about even social media. Okay. Are you posting on social media because you really believe in what you want to say, or because you think you look cute and you want a bunch of people to like your picture, you know? And if it's because you think you look cute and you want a bunch of people to like your picture, that's totally cool. Then say feeling cute or whatever. But I think it's some of that too, is just really stopping myself and asking, okay, Cassandra, why do you want this? Why would you want this achievement? Why would you want this award? Or why would you want this thing? Is it because you want that? Or do you want the feeling that's attached to it? Right. And if you're just seeking a feeling and you just want the feeling that's attached to something, that's a problem. And or at least for me, it was, you know, because it's really easy to get in that pattern too, right? I mean, think about, it's like seeking attention and seeking excitement, and instead of being able to be still and sit with yourself. It, for me, that was a huge barrier.
Absolutely. I think what you said before about, you know, relationships, and you're sort of, it's sort of sounding like, you know, you're willing to just like break your back for someone just because you want them to like acknowledge that you were there and that you went the extra mile, but deep down inside, you know, you're stressed, you're anxious, maybe you jumbled your entire schedule to be a part of something that you truly could have just said no to, but you didn't want to deal with that supposed backlash that you would ultimately receive. And I think it's so interesting because like that's what our society is facing right now so much, right? I saw such a good quote on social media the other day, surprisingly, where it was essentially alluding to the fact that, you know, don't use COVID as a way to judge your friendships, right? Everyone's going through their own thing right now. Don't be like, oh, if you don't contact me during COVID, then you weren't really my friend, right? It's like people are dealing with their own things right now, and everyone needs their own space to breathe. So please don't use a global pandemic as a means to test your friendships.
Right.
It was such a big quote for me when I was sort of reading that over, because it, you know, to what extent are we putting pressure on ourselves in order to just like get approval?
Oh my gosh, so much. And that's it, you know, it starts, it's embedded in our whole society. And that's what's hard, is because of course we want approval and we want people to like us and things like that. But then it becomes almost this thing where we feel we need it in right. terms of like to function. And that's where like the interesting thing for me has been, I am so much more able to just be still, if that makes sense, in terms of like, because I'm not constantly thinking about what I need from other people, because I can get more just satisfaction, I guess, from myself now. Sure. I don't need to seek it out from other people as much.
Absolutely. What are some things that you want our listeners to take away from this episode and from listening to you and from reading your book?
The biggest thing for me is I really want, I always tell my students that I'm trying to build this army of emotionally healthy people. Because I think that that's how we take over the world. That's how we change the world, is if, you know, more people were aware of how to talk about the things that they've been through and to share their emotions, I think we could be a more emotionally healthy place, I think, overall in the world, in terms of, you know, recognizing that everybody's going through something and being more compassionate and more kind. And so what I would want people to take away is really to start looking at what your needs are, start looking at the things that are important to you and what you value, and then learning how to articulate those to your relational partners, your friends, your family members, your coworkers, whoever it is, your children. Because if you start with that place of awareness, if you start with that piece of openness and you learn what that is for you, then you get to go and communicate that to your friends. And that's how we also learn to set boundaries. So for example, if you know what's important to you and what's right for you, and you can clearly articulate that, then in your relationships, if something doesn't go along with that, you already can go back to your base and be like, oh yeah, this isn't really work for me. Yeah. As opposed to like, if you don't know what you want and don't know who you are, you don't have your needs figured out, then it's much easier to just enter into situations or relationships that don't work for you because mm-hmm. you're not going back to your own personal needs. So like, it's really big for me that people kind of start with themselves before you can work on your relationship. Like you have to figure it out a little bit for yourself first. So for me, that really did mean looking at, you know, these pieces that I didn't want to address. And unfortunately, I think that's what it means for a lot of people, is like going back to some of those areas and telling yourself some hard truths. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I had to fix, yes, I was abused. Yes, that was awful. But a lot of the stuff I had to fix was my own doing. It was my own negative patterns. It was the things I was contributing. And that's hard, you know, yeah. Nobody wants to go and look at themselves and say, oh gosh, here's how I messed this up, or this is where I'm not the best at, you know, right. being in a, and so, I think it's so important though, because I think that's how we build foundations for happier relationships. And that's how we get to a place where we can also start to share and be more open, because, you know, back to building this army of emotionally healthy people is, I do. I want people, whatever your trauma or your crisis or the thing that you're going through, I want to have safe spaces. I want you to feel like you can talk about that. And one way we can do that is by, like I say, creating people who are more compassionate and kind and open, so that if you do share, you know, you finally do open up about something that's bothering you, then you're also given a safe space to do that. You're met with responses that encourage you. You're met with responses that make you feel safe, like, because that's so important. So it's kind of like this twisted web of all of the things I want, I guess. So I want people to be aware of what they need. I want them to be able to talk about it. And then I want them to respond to others in a kind and compassionate way. Those are my calls to
action. Yes, that's the dream. That is the dream.
That's the dream.
So I asked the same question to all of our guests on Fem Radio, and it is, who embodies the word fem to you? And we use the word fem to describe an all-around trailblazer, just someone who's really working her butt off and helping others in the process, right? An ally, a mentor. And, you know, I say her, but this really is across the spectrum, right? In recent months, I've definitely gotten a lot of men, right, that are allies for some. So feel free to share whoever comes to mind.
Well, so my personal hero, I guess, or person who has been a guiding force for me for a very long time is Oprah. And I say her for multiple reasons and on multiple levels. But I think for me, it starts with just even her story of knowing that she grew up and had to work very hard through some things and work her way up in her industry and get to a place where she, you know, was at the top of her field, is at the top of her field. But every step of the way, if you look back, you know, through from her TV show, from the magazine, all of these different things, she has also shared her struggles. She hasn't gotten strong and gotten to where she is by pretending to be somebody she's not, or by making it seem like it was really easy. She, you know, like think about even, I know a lot of people who used to watch her show, her weight loss and her weight gain, she would talk about those things or her, anyway, I'm rambling a little bit because I could talk about Oprah forever. But basically for me, it's her, because again, she's had struggles, she's had trauma, she's had crisis, but she's met them with this spirit of determination. And through sharing her story, I think she empowers other people. And that's all I want to do. I want to share my story so that it can empower other people to share theirs. So she did that for me.
I love that. And I truly, truly believe that you're already doing that and empowering so many people. And I can't wait for our listeners to actually get this episode and to listen to it, because I think you're really going to inspire a lot of them to share their stories and to recover from trauma or even just negative experiences and stress. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for sharing all of that with us. Where can our listeners follow you on social media, buy your book, tell us all the good things?
So you can follow me on social media on Instagram or Facebook at Dr. Cassandra LeClaire. My book is available, it's on Audible. If you're an audiobook listener, I narrated it. So if you like the sound of my voice, go to Audible. otherwise it's, you know, Barnes & Noble, Apple Books, Amazon. It's out there on most platforms. And again, it's called Being Whole, Healing from Trauma and Reclaiming My Voice.
Thank you so much. Any last pieces of advice for our listeners?
I guess the main thing I hope that everyone can find a safe space to share their story. So I would just say, start thinking about the things you don't want to think about and start trying to heal from them.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This was wonderful. I'm so glad we got to talk and have this time together.
Do you know any trailblazing females that you think we should be featuring? Send us an email at femmete@gmail.com. That's femmete@gmail.com. As always, thank you for your support as we strive to promote the growth of diverse women in all industries. #GetFemmed.